From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. Investors actually have something to sing about as they ring in the new year tonight. Stock prices are up in 2010. The Dow Industrial Average gained 11% this year, and the S&P 500 gained 13%. That's a broader measure of overall market performance. So after some rockier times, that's some good news for the economy, a sign of rebound in action. But there are also those scarier signs, a weak job market, and the European banking crisis, just to name two. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Lizanne Saunders has been looking on the bright side for a long time. Saunders is chief market strategist at Charles Schwab, and she's been seeing signs of a turnaround for a while.
In the spring of 2009, I felt very strongly that I had to apologize for optimism because it was certainly not a very popular position to have.
Even though the economy was flat on its back, Saunders was urging investors to stay the course. To make big money in the market, she said, you have to come in when most people are feeling scared, when no one can see the recovery coming. This year, Saunders has had her optimism tested again. For the first few months of the year, stocks did well. Then everything changed.
Violence on the streets of Athens as anger over harsh economic cutbacks boiled over. Three people died when protesters firebombed a bank, a symbolic target in Greece's troubled times.
Countries such as Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, which had borrowed heavily during the boom, were having trouble paying their debts. A lot of big banks had lent money to these countries, and for a time it seemed like the second wave of the banking crisis that had brought down Lehman Brothers. David Kelly is chief market strategist at JP Morgan Funds.
The fear was that if one of these sovereign countries was to default, the banking system in Europe and the banking system around the world would take it on the chin again.
On May 6th, in the middle of the crisis, came the flash crash, when the Dow fell more than 600 points in a few minutes. It was the kind of event that seared itself into the nervous systems of traders.
Here comes Morgan Stanley to sell. Morgan Stanley comes in and sells 100 cars.
This recording of Chicago futures trader Ben Lichtenstein responding to the crash became a hit on YouTube.
Guys, once again, 75 even offer here now, guys. 70 even offer. 69 trade.
The flash crash would later be blamed on an unusual trade by a mutual fund company that set off a fierce round of computer-driven selling. The market rebounded as quickly as it fell, and soon, David Kelly says, European governments organized a bailout that eased the banking crisis.
I think that really reassured a lot of investors, and they've had doubts since then, but every time people have doubted what European governments were going to do, they've been very resolute in saying, we are going to make sure that nobody defaults here.
In the months since then, there have been slow but steady signs that the economy is rebounding, that the job market is still weak. The Federal Reserve embarked on a controversial program of quantitative easing, buying up government securities to stimulate the economy. All that seems to have persuaded investors that the rebound is for real. Stocks have been steadily rising. But David Kelly says the wild swings of the past few years have left investors cautious.
It's funny, a few years ago, everybody was asking me, what are the hot areas in markets? And now nobody wants a hot area for fear they're going to eventually get burned.
Among the stocks that are rising the fastest are technology and consumer companies. Lizanne Saunders says she still believes investors are underestimating the strength of the recovery.
I don't have an expectation that we're going to have a boom in 2011, but I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised relative to what are still fairly subdued expectations.
So has it become a little easier to be an optimist?
I feel like I no longer have to apologize for for my optimism, and that has taken a while.
Saunders says at some point investor sentiment will turn more positive. She says that may be the time when the financial markets are overheating again, and investors should think about pulling out. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. One of the most popular programs for helping the world's poor has gone sour in India. Microcredit, the practice of making small loans to very poor people, is a multi-billion dollar industry. But microfinance companies are now accused of predatory lending and collection practices so harsh that they drove some borrowers to suicide. One state government in India has enacted legislation that will, in effect, put the microlenders out of business. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports from New Delhi.
The idea behind microcredit is to give a small loan to a very poor person to buy some asset that will help her work her way out of poverty.
Our typical client is a woman, poor woman, residing in a slum or in a village.
That's Shubhankar Sengupta, the director of a Kolkata-based microfinance company called Arohan Financial Services.
She may be involved in running a very petty trade, like selling vegetables on the roadside shop, or she could be a wage laborer, works in agricultural fields.
As little as $200, the theory goes, could allow a woman like that to buy more goods to sell, or a couple of goats to milk, or a sewing machine to make clothing. A working asset could increase her ability to earn a living and make enough extra to repay the loan with interest. The up-by-your-bootstraps capitalism of this idea was so appealing to thinkers in the developed world that one of the pioneers of microfinance, Mohammed Yunus of Bangladesh, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. But microcredit in India doesn't come cheap. The cost may be shocking to anyone in the United States who's ever borrowed for a car or a house.
Just so that your audience can brace themselves, the typical interest rates are in the range of 24% to 30% per annum. Most people find it very hard that this interest rate does any good to poor people who are the recipients.
That's Vijay Mahajan, the president of the Microfinance Institutions Network, a trade group. One reason interest rates are so high, Mahajan says, is that micro-lending is very time and labor intensive. Microfinance lenders do their business on the client's doorstep, meaning that representatives have to travel to slums or rural villages to make the loans and then come back weekly to collect the payments. But microfinance was also very profitable, so much so, Sengupta says, that it made sense to run it as a commercial venture, tapping into investment banks for the vast amounts of money needed to fuel the growing number of microloans. It was so profitable that one company, SKS Microfinance, raised $357 million when it went public on the Mumbai Stock Exchange in August. Let's go back to that typical microfinance client. This is Rama, a woman who earns a living rolling bidis, the cheap little cigars smoked by India's poorest people. She lives in the town of Warangal, a farming center in rural Andhra Pradesh, one of the poorest states in South India. One woman cuts the leaves into shape while Rama and others roll the smokes and bundle them into baskets. A quick, persistent worker can earn between 30 and 40 rupees rolling bidis, less than a dollar a day. Rama says microfinance representatives offered her a loan with almost no questions asked. She took it, though she didn't have a plan to invest the money or pay it back. She used the money for household expenses, for medical treatment for family members, and to celebrate a birthday. A second company offered her another loan, which she used to make payments on the first. Professor Kurapati Venkata Nurayana says Rama began a downward spiral that's common among debtors in Warangal.
They get the loan from second company and pay to the first company. They take the third loan from third company, and they pay to the first and second company.
Before long, Rama had five loans from different companies and no way to pay. She says the collectors from the finance companies hounded her day and night, shaming her in front of her neighbors. They told her to get the money any way she could, by stealing if necessary, and they told her she'd be better off dead. Venkata Narayana says that's because, unbeknownst to her, Rama's loan payments had included a life insurance premium.
If the people, borrowers, die, the microfinance companies get the insurance amount.
Rama says her 17-year-old daughter, Monica, took the threats to heart. Monica believed that if anyone in the family committed suicide, the debts would somehow be erased.
She went inside the kitchen and got herself fire, and after 2 days she died.
She doused herself with kerosene from the stove. It took 2 days for her to die from the burns. Venkata Narayana, who teaches economics at Kakatiya University in Warangal, says he's been keeping count. And so far this year, more than 120 people, most of them women, have committed suicide in Andhra Pradesh because of the burden of microfinance debt. Andhra Pradesh, a sprawling, heavily populated state, is home to about 75% of the microfinance companies in India. Most are based here, in the state capital of Hyderabad, a modern, bustling city that's so tied into the information technology business that its nickname is Cyberabad. After the outcry over the suicides, the state assembly passed a law that makes it so difficult to make loans that the microfinance companies say they won't be able to do business. Vijay Mahajan says the companies haven't been able to collect on their loans, even from people who can afford to repay.
Political leaders have been going around and saying, do not repay MFI loans. So our repayment rates, which all these 15 years have been around 98 to 99%, have come down to less than 10%. So there's a major default that's beginning to happen.
Microfinance companies may not be able to repay hundreds of millions of dollars in loans that they have outstanding from banks. Mahajan acknowledges that greedy lenders and unchecked growth have given the microfinance business a bad name. But he says that shutting down the industry will ultimately hurt the poor. At 56, he's worked most of his life for nonprofit development groups. He says that he got into commercial microfinance because he saw it as the only way to increase the scale of financial services to India's poor, not just lending, but access to savings accounts and insurance, the things people in wealthy countries take for granted. Now, he says, that cause may have been set back by at least a decade. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, New Delhi.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. 2010 could not have ended too soon for the millions of Americans who spent the year struggling to find jobs or avoid foreclosure notices. Now it's a new year, and lots of economists are seeing reasons for optimism. Joining us to discuss those economic predictions is NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Geewax. Marilyn, welcome back, and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Leanne.
Will it be a Happy New Year? Will 2011 really be better than 2010?
Let's hope so. This economic downturn started up more than 3 years ago, and although the official recession is over, it just doesn't feel that way to a lot of Americans. We've had a painfully slow recovery. We still have so many people facing foreclosures, searching for work. But increasingly, economists say they see the evidence that growth is picking up. In recent weeks, they've been raising their growth estimates. And at this point, the mainstream view is that the economy is going to grow at about 3 to 3.5% in 2011. That's vastly better than where we were a couple of years ago. Remember when President Obama came into office 2 years ago this month, the economy was shrinking by more than 6%. So without question, we're really in much better shape heading into 2011. But, and this is a very big but, 3% growth is still way too slow to create enough jobs to soak up those 15 million Americans who are looking for jobs. And to get the jobs market really going again, we'd need to have about 300,000 to 400,000 jobs created every month. And that's 10 times the number of new jobs that we saw in November.
What about housing?
The consensus view is that housing is moving into a recovery, but most of the improvement won't come until later in the year. Last week, Mark Zandi, the chief economist for Moody's Analytics, shared his outlook with NPR.
Well, housing hits bottom in 2011. It's been a five-year road south. It's been a complete cratering of the market, but I think 2011 marks the end of that crash. We've got more price declines to go. We've got a fair amount of foreclosed property that are still going to come to market, but by summer, fall, I think the price declines will be over. By the end of the year, we'll have price stability, and by 2012, some price growth.
That's Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody's Analytics, talking about the housing market. I'm speaking with Marilyn Geewax, NPR senior business editor. Marilyn, what are the economic wildcards?
Consumer prices and interest rates. Both of those could hold a lot of surprises for us. Some economists are still fearing deflation. In 2010, for the most part, inflation was very tame, so there's still this lingering fear that consumer demand could be so weak that prices could fall. And anybody who's seen the value of their home decline in recent years knows how painful deflation can be. But other economists are worried that prices are about to shoot up. We've got oil prices rising sharply. Crop prices have jumped up too. And we could see significant food and fuel inflation in 2011. If U.S. consumers end up having to spend more on their gasoline and groceries. Then there's less money for things like making the mortgage payment, buying clothes, going on vacation. All of that could really hurt the economy. And then there's the interest rate puzzle. The Fed's been trying to restrain interest rates, but you know, we see mortgage rates rising in recent weeks, and some economists fear they could really take off in the coming year.
Finally, Marilyn, what about the stock market?
Stock market was so volatile in 2010 that a lot of small investors were left feeling pretty discouraged and confused. But now forecasters are saying that stocks are going to do really well in 2011. We could see gains of 10%, maybe 20%. And historically, the third year of a presidential term is a pretty good one. But there are always risks. Prices could plunge because of profit-taking. There could be some currency crisis. So the stock market still feels pretty scary to most of us. But as I said, economists are not really focused on those risks and dangers for 2011. For the most part, right now, the outlook is positive, with lots of forecasts out there calling for decent economic growth, fairly stable consumer prices, and rising stock prices. So, Leanne, Happy New Year.
Indeed. NPR's Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome, Leanne.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden. This week, a Moscow judge imposed a new 14-year prison sentence on a former Russian oil tycoon charged with embezzlement and money laundering. The United States and other Western countries denounced the decision as politically motivated. The case is considered one of the most important trials in Russia's post-Soviet era. For more, we're joined by Joe Nocera, business columnist for The New York Times. He's at our New York bureau. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Joe, you wrote that it took the judge, is this right, more than 3 days to read his decision against Mikhail Khodorkovsky?
Yes, it was an 800-page decision, although people who are in the courtroom tell me that basically he was just reading, by and large, from the prosecutor's initial indictment.
Okay. So explain this case briefly to us.
Well, the political aspect of it is, you know, he is Vladimir Putin's number one enemy, and Putin has had him in jail for 6 or 7 years on trumped-up tax charges. They appropriated the company, Yukos, that he ran, which was, by the way, the best-run company in Russia. They gave it to another state-run oil company. And now, with his parole approaching, they don't want him out of jail. So they made even more absurd charges this time around. And, you know, he was found, of course, guilty as charged.
So 6 more years in jail. From a business perspective, how do you think this will impact Russia's economy?
It's a terrible signal to send to the business community. Obviously, this has human rights and political implications, but the business implication is not insignificant. Russia is a country in desperate need of foreign capital. It's about to try and do a 2-year privatization program where it's going to sell off minority shares of state-run companies. And one of the companies where it's going to sell these minority shares is Rosneft. Rosneft is the company that wound up with all the Yukos assets. So basically, having stolen investors' assets 6 years ago, they now want to resell them, these stolen assets, to a new round of investors. It's part of the reason why Russia has had such a terrible time sort of climbing out of economic difficulty, because foreign investors don't want to do business there.
Now, what about specifically, you know, economic relations between Russia and the U.S.?
Well, they won't change that much. I mean, the Obama administration has, for the first time, made some, you know, moderately strong statements about this case. But the truth of the matter is that the U.S. and Russia have, you know, nuclear treaties and so many things that they have to deal with that it's a little unlikely and a little unfortunate, I would add, that the administration is not going to put this case at the top of their grievances, but they probably won't.
Okay. Well, Joe, before we let you go, it's the start of a new year, and we're putting a twist here on some traditional resolutions, something we're calling New Year's resolutions for other people. So here's your chance. What resolutions would you like to offer for the movers and shakers in the economy?
All right. So resolution number one, the House Republicans and the Financial Services Committee have vowed to reform Fannie and Freddie and try and get the government out of the housing market. Given the fact that the government now guarantees 95% of all mortgages and without which there would be no housing market, I wish them well in this resolution, but I think it's going to go the way of most New Year's resolutions.
Along with the diet, okay.
Right. Resolution number two, Bank of America, their resolution is to modify every loan that is in default. They have basically been knee-deep in every mortgage problem or scandal that has come along this year, you know, taking over people's houses that were not in default, the robo-signing scandal that came along a few months ago. Time after time, unfortunately for them, they own Countrywide, and Countrywide was the worst mortgage maker in the country at the end of the subprime bubble, and so there's another resolution that's probably going to go by the books. Resolution number three for me is Ben Bernanke resolves that the next time he comes up with his stimulus plan, it won't sound like a cruise ship.
Do you have an acronym ready?
Yeah, I haven't figured that out yet. That's my resolution. But, you know, this one was called QE2 for quantitative easing number two. It was hugely controversial, although so far the world has not come to an end because of it. My final resolution is for President Obama. His resolution is going to somehow figure out how to make Elizabeth Warren the official Senate-appointed head of the new Consumer Protection Bureau, which I might add starts up officially in July.
And she's in there temporarily now,
that's
right?
Right, and she's done it without Senate appointment, but she's quote-unquote an advisor to the president, and she is not officially got this job. But you know, I do think she would be the best person for the job. She cares about these issues passionately. She understands them. It's good that she's in there helping to set up this agency. So I'm hoping that this is one resolution that the president, who has proved to be remarkably effective since the November election, is one that he can pull off.
All right. Well, we'll stay in touch with you to see how that goes. Jonah Serra is a business columnist for The New York Times. His new book is All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. He joined us from our New York bureau. Joe, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, and Happy New Year.